This content is issued by Zeus Capital Limited, which is authorised and regulated in the United Kingdom by the Financial Conduct Authority for designated investment business and is a member firm of the London Stock Exchange. Nothing in this podcast should be viewed as investment advice. Listeners should consult an investment professional before making any decisions regarding topics mentioned in this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and not of Zeus. Please note that participants in this podcast may have financial interests in the matters discussed. It's Thursday, 21st of March. With me today, I have Hooman Ashrafzadeh. Hooman started his career in finance, but pivoted to become an entrepreneur and is co-founder of Urban Greens, the London-based salad bars, and is also founder of Paddium, the UK's paddle tennis club, having recently opened a venue in Canary Wharf.
Thank you so much, Nick.
A pleasure to see you today, actually. I mean, as I always like to start with a bit of background on you, where would you like to start?
I think I would like to start from the teenage years.
Of course.
Where I grew up. I'm originally Iranian, but my family moved to Sweden when I was two, and I grew up in Sweden. So Sweden has been my home and still is till today. But I have spent half of my life in London and half of it in Sweden, I would say. But if we go back, I always had a drive from an early age to leave Sweden and explore the world. So yeah, I moved to London with aspirations of entering into the world of finance. And I graduated in late 2008. And I think it was just before Lehman Brothers collapsed when I graduated. And it was a tough time getting into finance back then. And I studied at Cass Business School, and I think that year was one of the years when most students actually returned back to their countries. There were just very few graduate schemes in the industry in London. But I managed to get into the industry and started working. Initially, it was just contracting jobs because there were no full-time offers offered, but stayed on, worked in finance, and I think the most sort of the roles that I aspired to be in were always the front office roles with either trading or client-facing roles and sales. So yeah, I managed to get into a trading role. I was working for a company called IG, and I was doing all kinds of different asset classes as a sales trader. So I was dealing with high net worth individuals and in smaller institutions that were trading equities and FX and commodities, and I had really enjoyed that role. It was fun. It was the right kind of environment to be in. It was quite aspiring and inspiring. But at the end of the day, I think from a very early age, there was this entrepreneurial thing that was like pulling me, like I want to do my own thing. I mean, I remember when I was 13, 14 years old, I would buy MP3 players from China, have them sent to me to Sweden, and then selling them off like on a equivalent Gumtree sort of a page, and doing these sort of smaller side hustles, but always have a little side income. So that part was always there. But when I started working in finance and doing this trading role, I found myself in situations where, you know, when it was time for promotion and things like that, I just felt that there was so much politics involved in bureaucracy, and it was just like, you know, the person who deserved the role was not always the one getting there. And it came to a point where I felt like, you know what, this is not the place for me if I want to really progress. And equally so, some of the managers that I would have, not just at my last role, but throughout my career in finance, I often felt like this is not exactly inspiring. This is not what I'm aspiring to be. I want something more than this. So that was in the back of my mind. And I think that the move into doing my own thing was always there, constantly. And I've tried several things. I remember I was I worked for Bloomberg for a couple of years as well. And whilst working at Bloomberg, I, together with another friend, we started a food business on the side. But I mean, I was 22 years old, so lost a lot of money and gained some experience, but, you know, had a few of these failures as well. But I would say the first real move into entrepreneurship was actually when I left IG, and I said, you know what, I have a good clients, a book of clients that I'm having great relationships with. I think I can do this on my own as a broker. So I left my job. I waited this 6 months period of time that I wasn't allowed to touch any clients. But then after that, I set up my own sort of introductory broker business where I then had relationships with other brokerage firms and then had my clients being basically a funnel. They still wanted to chat to me on a day-to-day basis, but then the execution would be taking place in a partner firm with me. So that was really good. That basically, when I made that move, I within months, I started making more money than I had ever made in my corporate career. And I was doing this for some time, quite actively for a few years. And then I realized that, you know, money is not the main sort of drive within me. I thought it was, but I realized that building this business didn't really have much purpose to it. You know, I had clients that were trading, and I was making a cut from it, and I was making good money, but I wasn't building anything. I wasn't leaving anything behind. I thought to myself, you know, 5 years down the line, if I look back on time, what have I actually created? Can I point to something? And the answer was no. All I had done was markets had been moving up and down, and I've been taking bips here and there and make commissions off of it.
I know how you feel.
You know, there was another part of me that was missing. And I felt like, first of all, I'm making money, but I'm not learning much. You know, I'm just continuing doing what I've learned at work. And it's this lack of purpose. So what I then decided was like, okay, I've created this business. It's actually generating a good passive income for me. Even if I would just leave my clients alone, the ones that I had, and they would continue, that would generate revenue. And that was great. So having had that, I decided to let me go back into a role, a corporate role, which still challenges me, teaches me things. And apart from finance, when I was early in my career, I was also eyeing management consultancy. And I think more and more when I had explored finance, I thought to myself that management consultancy is where I want to be, because that's where I really understand business challenges of a business and helping resolve those issues. So I started working for a Swedish boutique management consultancy firm, and that was great. I really learned so much about all these aspects. Mm-hmm. But again, after around 3 years of being in this business, I already had a taste of being full-time entrepreneur, and working for another company again felt like, you know what, this isn't, you know, this is what I worked hard to get away from. So you know, I've had lots of ideas, but one idea that really came to me was during this time I was in Stockholm, by the way, when I worked for the consultancy company, I saw the trend of sort of healthy fast food popping up everywhere in Sweden, and I looked to London and I saw that, you know, this is it's a great place for food. You have the best restaurants, but back then, and I think it was around 7 years ago, they're just nowhere to go for healthy lunch. Like, you know, you could have healthy lunches, but they weren't very exciting. They weren't tasty. So that there was a gap in the market, I felt. And I've always had a very big passion for food and, you know, travel to places just to explore certain restaurants. And I discussed this idea with two of my very good friends that I'd met at uni, and both of them based in London at that time. They really liked the idea as well. So the idea was to start a healthy fast food chain, a salad bar, a more premium salad bar. So we started thinking, we started working together on this and just putting together the concepts whilst working as a management consultant, and my business partners, they were in finance and or family business. And we were working on the concept for probably 2 years until it became mature enough for us to then take the leap and leave our job. So then that's, I left my consultancy gig in 2018. To then go full time running or starting on Urban Greens, and we launched our first restaurant in July 2019. And you know, as you can imagine, shortly after our launch, 6-7 months after, we were facing some crazy challenges. But I mean, without going too much into detail about all the challenges we faced, we still did fairly well. So we came out of the pandemic with, having still managed to grow the business. We increased our customer base. We did a lot of deliveries. And then through that, we then opened up our second store right after COVID, between the lockdowns and whatever. It was just around, 2021, we opened up our second store. And then today we have four stores across London, and we're opening up our fifth one in the next 2-3 months.
Where are the four stores?
So the first one is in St. James's Park or near Victoria. Second store opened up in Canary Wharf. Third one opened up in St. Paul's. And the fourth one opened up just 2 months ago in High Street, Kensington.
Where's the fifth one going to be?
Fifth one is going to be close to Moorgate.
So again, those city workers needing a healthier lunch option. And how did you cope? I mean, I understand that running restaurants is very difficult, and I also, there are so many input cost pressures, even post COVID, national living wage, etc. I mean, supply or input cost pressures. How do you juggle those?
I think honestly, when we think back on time, COVID was difficult. Just starting a business in the restaurant industry on its own without any of these challenges is tough. A lot of companies, they don't survive it. But when I look back on this journey and think of COVID was very difficult. But coming out of COVID, I think that part was even more difficult, where, the impacts of Brexit was there. There were just shortages of staff. Prices were going up. It was impossible to hire people and keep them. It was just really, really, that part was more difficult than COVID. I think the good thing is, me and my business partners, we have a business background. And from our corporate careers, we learned to go through challenges, not the same way as an entrepreneur, but we learned, and that mindset was there from the beginning, that challenges will come. You just have to be prepared for them. Just you being able to pivot all the time and being nimble and stay on your toes. And when one challenge just hits you, just, face the fact that they will be there. It's just a matter of your mindset of how you go through it. And I think that's super important as an entrepreneur. You just have to be prepared for all kinds of different difficult situations. I would say that the mentality and mindset is the most important thing when it comes to this, to go through these challenges.
And then your two other business partners, do you each specialize in a portion of the business that maybe your natural attributes drive you towards, or is it a bit more linear?
So we're three business partners. One of us is more passive. Yanis lives in Greece, and it's me and Rushil. We're both London-based. We're the ones running the business. So between me and Rushil, who are active, we never really had a clear line of this is what I do, this is what you do. We kind of like naturally fell into those areas that were, the skill sets that we have. But equally, there are things that we do together, which works really well. I would say we still till today, 5 years since we opened our first store, don't have exact roles of who does what, which has worked out really well. But yeah, it comes down to the fact that we know each other super well, and we can trust each other, and we're very good friends as a base.
Then what's the long-term vision for Urban Greens? How many outlets could there be in London and then expanding outside of London?
So we have until today only been funding this ourselves. So we don't have any external capital coming in. But for the first time now, we're open to scale this faster. And we are having dialogues with various different parties who are interested in our brand and wanting to invest. So the idea is for us to now take on investment to really grow this. We founded the business ourselves. We worked in the business for the first 2 years, as in actually working in the stores. Yeah. And come to a point where we built the foundation quite solid. We're on top of our operations. We know what we're doing. We're profitable. But, we deliberately did not take on any external capital until we felt like we're really ready for it. So right now, is the stage where we feel like we're ready to scale. And I think what we wanted, I mean, the possibilities that we feel would be right for London would be probably around 15 to 20 locations. Mm-hmm. And then we've had quite a lot of interest from internationally sort of licensing deals in other countries and the Middle East and so on. And that's something we're exploring as well. But there's a lot of, there's a huge demand for the category that we were in. It's great to see that it's not just us. We also have competitors that are growing in this field. And it's really nice to see that, you know, that this industry is changing. People are becoming much, much more aware of what they're eating. So yeah, we're in a good space.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And then, so that's been going for since 2018. And then how do you have time to do anything else?
I think as you grow the business, you have to kind of start delegating and building good teams that that then take on board your sort of previous responsibilities. And we've done that in a good way. So we've grown, we've hired good people. It's really, really important to have good people as part of your team. And then the more you sort of grow the business, the less involved you get into the smaller details, and you start working on the business as opposed to in the business.
Exactly.
And once you make that switch of being able to work on the business, you're not as time challenged with time. You're more taking bigger decisions and less decision, but each decision is more significant. So given the fact that you come to that point, that I think it's really, really important as you grow a business that you have this mindset that you need to disconnect yourself from the business as you grow. Otherwise, it's going to be very limiting what you can do and how much you can scale. So I think in the last 3 years, we actively worked on the fact that disconnecting ourselves from the business, working on the business and hiring good people. So with that said, the business has matured to a point where both me and my business partner are not required to be there on a day-to-day basis. We don't need to deal with the smaller decisions, and that has freed up time.
You're not chopping lettuce anymore?
No, we're not chopping lettuce. I've chopped enough lettuce. Well, in fact, we don't have lettuce on our menu, but I've chopped enough salad and vegetables in my days in the early days of Urban Greens, which was really good. Like, we learned every single aspect of the business, but naturally, you have to evolve from that.
That makes a lot of sense. And then shall we pivot to paddle?
Yeah, let's pivot to paddle.
How did that come about? Or what first of all, what is it? What are you trying to grow? And I think maybe talk more generally about paddle and the explosion of paddle in the UK for the last 2 to 3 years.
Okay. So some basics about paddle. Paddle is, I would say in one sentence, it's a perfect combination between tennis and squash. So you have elements from both of those sports. You play two on two on a court which is covered by glass walls. The court is around less than half of the size of a tennis court. And the ball looks like a tennis ball, just slightly less pressured. And the bats, I don't know how to explain them. There are no strings to them. They're just made of slightly smaller.
Yeah.
And then the way you play is like tennis. You play, you know, over a net and then two players on each side. But you can also use the walls in your advantage. So if you're getting someone smashing and you're not getting it on the first attempt, you can wait for the ball to bounce off the wall and then take it. Sport was invented, I think, by an accident by someone in Mexico in the late 60s. They were building a tennis court and they built a wall around it so the balls wouldn't fly out. And then they realized that this is a new sport and this is quite fun. From there, it took off in Spain. It grew in the 70s, became a big thing there. And then Spain has had the sport, since the 70s and just grown. And I think today you have more paddle players in Spain than you have tennis players. And then Spain was a catalyst. From Spain, it grew to other European countries and Sweden, a country where I grew up in. You know, you have a lot of people living in Spain partly or going there for holidays. And I think they had a lot of exposure. They played the game and they realized how much fun it is and how great it is. And they brought it to Sweden. So Sweden was one of the countries where paddle just exploded. And early on, we probably had it for 10 years over there. And that's where I came across the sport early on. So I think around, five, 6 years ago, I first saw it and I started playing it whilst being home on my holidays, visiting family. And it didn't take many times for me to really get hooked and loving the game. I think I played two or three times and I said, this is incredible. This is going to be my next thing in terms of me wanting to play it. And then coming back to London, at that time, we had two courts outdoors and they were always fully booked or, you know, the rain.
Or it was raining.
Yeah, or it was raining. So this whole idea grew in within me, starting from like a frustration of not being able to play it. You know, I came in all excited back from Sweden, told all my friends, buy paddle rackets. I've discovered this new sport and there was no way to play it. So that's when, as I started looking into the industry and I looked at paddle A in Sweden, I saw that it was growing in places like Italy, Spain, it was already huge. And then looking at UK, which is a huge racket nation, it was just odd to me that there was no paddle and that no one had thought about this before. But then speaking to people about it, no one knew what paddle was. They hadn't been exposed to it. And so then that's when I saw an opportunity. I thought to myself, you know, paddle is going to become a big thing. I can easily see it. It's a social sport. It's fun. It's easy to learn. That's one of the main things with paddle. It's not as difficult as tennis. You can have one, two sessions as beginners and already within those two sessions come to a point where you can have a great game together with other people. And for those reasons, I saw that it was quite an interesting space to enter into. And then I made a little business plan. I thought to myself, okay, how is this business working? I needed some courts. I need some space and so on and so on. So I made a simple business plan, started talking to some friends about it here in London. And kind of like saying, you know, this would be an interesting project. Is there any interest for people to invest? And I had zero interest from people here in the UK. Yeah. Naturally, they didn't know what it was. And only I had seen it amongst my contacts. But I wasn't giving up on the idea. I started looking into it more and more. I started speaking to companies that build these courts and clubs across the UK. Not across the UK, across Europe. The idea became sort of more and more, I was more and more convinced about it. And then I was having dinner with one of my good friends in Sweden, Martin Lorentzen, a few years ago, and the topic of paddle came up. And I said, actually, he loves paddles and he plays it 5-6 times a week and, you know, a huge fan. And as we were on the topic, I said, by the way, I'm looking to open up something in London. We have two courts in the entire city. And that was when we sort of very informally decided that, you know, if this is the case and there are so few courts and it is what you say, then I'd love to be part of this journey with you. So that was like a very casual handshake deal. And then with Martin in my sort of with me as a business partner, as a potential investor, I was then more confident to go and speak to the bigger landlords. And that's when the whole story started. And I went to Canary Wharf and I said, you know, I was already a tenant there with one of my restaurants.
Yes.
So I already had an established relationship with them. They were happy with me as a tenant. They know that I pay a lot of attention to detail and branding is an important thing. And I know how they are as a landlord as well. They're very picky. They have extremely high standards with everything. And my vision then started elevating and I thought to myself, well, if we're going to do it, we need to do it in a right way, in a flagship way. A lot of people still don't know what paddle is. So we need to really be in a spot which is easily accessible. And that's when the conversation progressed with Canary Wharf and we decided to build the most premium club in the UK, which I think we are.
So you're now open?
Yes. So this journey with Canary Wharf started 3 years ago, but we launched, it was a long process. It was quite a complex build, but we launched the club just over 6 months ago.
And is it a membership club or is it a pay-to-play club?
It's a pay-and-play club. So I like the Swedish model here that, you know, it's quite inclusive. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of sort of memberships only clubs, which is impossible to get involved unless your ancestor were members and so on.
Of course.
I like to keep it inclusive, but premium, but inclusive. So it's a pay and play model. Anyone can come and play, but I do have a membership element to it as well, where members get a few more benefits. For example, they get a longer time to sort of, they can book more in advance than a non-member and they get discounts on off peak hours and a few other things.
So how many courts?
We have 8 courts, 7 of them indoors, 1 outdoor, and soon expanding to one additional outdoor court as well. So 9 courts soon.
And are you doing lessons? Are you doing lessons?
Yes, we do lessons. We have coaches that they do one-on-one lessons, group lessons, academies and courses and classes.
Oh, fantastic. I will be looking at, I had a quick look at your very sleek website before we started this, but I'll be back to book my beginner lesson shortly.
You're very welcome.
And so how's that taken off? I mean, how far advanced am I able to book a court? How often are they booked? I mean, is it beginning to take off? I know that a lot of my friends play paddle already, and they're always moaning that there are not enough sites in London. So how has the last 6 months been?
It's been incredible. So just before we launched this, we had a lot of people who were super enthusiastic about paddle that had gone onto the planning permission websites, you know, the government websites, found out that we're building paddle, then found that the company that is doing it, doing the application belongs to me, and then reached out to me on LinkedIn. So I already had these people reaching out. Then we started announcing things on social media, and we already had, before we even launched, close to 4,000 people signing up to our newsletter. So there was already quite a lot of anticipation of us opening. And within 2 weeks of opening, I think, you know, and as you can book 1 week in advance as a non-member, our evenings were just fully booked within two weeks. And then obviously we're building a community here. It takes time. You need more people to play paddle. So that took a few more weeks to get to the point where we're getting busier and busier, not just the evening time, but also morning time, lunchtime. And we did a lot of introduction to paddle lessons, and we still do till today, because there's still a lot of people who don't know what paddle is, and we want to ease them into the sport. So those were just getting full, and today, 6 months down the line, we are incredibly busy. We're having I find it hard to find a spot myself unless I book quite a lot in advance, and then we started getting a lot of members signing up for membership because they wanted to have the good hours, and then they get two weeks in advance of booking rights. So today it's very busy, very busy. We could easily have another 10 courts, I think, and be at capacity.
I mean, from what I understand, there are quite a few other companies looking to roll out paddle courts throughout the UK. But what's the vision for your business?
My vision is to be the most premium and biggest brand of paddle in the UK. I think having that experience from hospitality of the restaurants, I have the experience of how to build a brand. I know how operations work. I think that combination of that together with the paddle business, it just becomes quite a unique thing. So, building a paddle club is not simply about putting some courts in a building. You need to build the community. You need to really activate the space. You need to engage with your customers and your members. And I think we found that way of how to do that in a nice way. So already in 6 months, we have so many people who have gotten to know each other, have become super close friends. And it's incredible. Also, my coaches, they tell me their clients, they invite them over for dinners, and they even hang out outside of the court. So it's just become so tight-knitted. It's great to see. That's my vision. I want to continue building that and building communities across the UK.
And I have to ask a very naive question, if I may. What's the difference between paddle and the American ugly sister of pickleball?
Fish. Different. I have never played pickleball, but I've seen it. It's the court size is less than half, I would say, than a pickle. Than a paddle court. You don't have any walls around it, so it's just a small court with a net in between, and the ball is a plastic ball filled with air. So, and the bat is smaller. It's a wooden bat. Yeah. So when you play, it's actually quite noisy. And you play 2-on-2. I think you can only do underarm shots. The difference is, I would say paddle is a real sport. Whereas, and I may offend a lot of pickleball players here, but I think if you compare the two, pickleball is more like a hobby. I wouldn't call it like as athletic as paddle. And I apologies if I'm offending the.
No, that makes sense because how you've described it. Paddle is very much a combination, a hybrid of squash and tennis, where I get the feeling pickleball is a little bit more across between sort of table tennis and badminton, but a bit, not as, I mean, hardcore is probably the wrong word, but not as athletic, maybe, shall I say?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, if we look at paddle, and paddle is one of the sports that everyone thinks will soon be introduced in the Olympics, hopefully in 2032. And would people ever think that pickleball would become an Olympic sport? I don't think they would.
No, that makes sense. And then have the large tennis brands and the large squash brands, have they really taken to paddle?
Yes, they have. We work together with Babolat. They're one of our sponsors. Yep. And I mean, they're huge in tennis and they're fairly, they're huge in paddle as well, and they've made that move into paddle, which is right. But you also have some brands that are purely paddle that have nothing to do with tennis. But there are tennis brands in paddle, and they're doing it well.
I feel like it's becoming quite a competitive market rolling out paddle courts. I might be wrong on that, but is it easy to get planning? Do planners understand the enthusiasm and the demand for courts?
I don't think so. Not yet. And UK is at its infant stage of paddle. We don't have many courts in the country. So you usually compare this to the number of tennis courts. And UK has 26,000 tennis courts. And we have less than 400 paddle courts. The issue is you need the ceiling heights when you play paddle. You need minimum 7.5 meters. So finding these sites is difficult. So many times you would have to build from scratch, or like we did, we build a canopy on top of ours, which require planning. And planning is difficult. It's one of the reasons why paddle has had such a slow growth in this country. But I feel like as the topic is becoming more and more popular, it's also easing up. I hope that would be the case down the line, that it wouldn't be as difficult, and that councils would also understand that this is a sport that really brings communities together. It's good for an area. So
no, I think that's that makes a lot of, that does make a lot of sense. And then how would you look to fund a rollout of another site?
We're doing another raise very soon. Funding raise. We have a good setup. Current investors in the cap table, and they're very willing to continue funding us. So it's not going to be an issue finding the money. In fact, it's crazy. I think I get one or two emails from serious players in the market on LinkedIn on a monthly basis that are interested in investing in paddle, and they've looked at the market and they think we're a good operator, and they reach out. It's a good position to be in, to be honest. But yeah, we have good backers that are willing to continue.
Yeah, hopefully that makes life a little bit easier in that case.
Yeah, it does.
And so, how many that vision for your paddle business? Is there a? I mean, I know you're going to be there for 6 months, but is there a rollout plan for other sites in London and then further afield?
Yeah, definitely. We're already looking at quite a few sites, not just in London, but across the UK. Nothing I can confirm right now, but within the next couple of months, I think we should secure a number of them. The plan is to continue. I mean, I'm not looking at having the most number of sites. I really want to go for premium locations, premium yeah. sites where the overall experience would be something quite unique. With, you know, I've turned down quite a few locations already because they're not fulfilling that value, the values that we have and the sort of as association as a brand that we want to have. But yeah, as I said, it depends. And I think as the market opens up and, you know, planners become a bit more comfortable with the idea, and also the real estate market is moving, and,
yes.
you know, we will see a potential of new opportunities coming up. So I'm quite excited about that. But we already have quite good leads for new sites.
And I guess with half the footprint of a tennis court or such, then actually, ironically, you don't need that much space. I appreciate there'll be changing rooms and shops, et cetera, but it's not a large footprint. You're not building a harbor club, I guess, every time.
The problem is you want to build them indoors because it rains all the time here. And yeah. if you want to build them indoors, then you need to spend a lot of money. So if you're spending a lot of money, you need to have a lot of courts in order to recoup your investment. Yeah. So yes, you still need a very significant amount of space. There is other models. Some competitors, they build courts adjacent to tennis clubs, or they build one or two courts in tennis clubs and do profit sharing model. That's not really what we do. I want to build a brand and an overall experience. And, you know, my aspiration is the premium gyms, the third space, or the Equinox.
Yes.
Those are, I want to be in that space of paddle. So the equivalent of third space in paddle. That's how I see it. And that comes with a lot of other things than just the courts. You need to have, premium facilities.
And is there an urban green within your paddle location currently?
Well, we have an urban greens, which is next to our Padium in Canary Wharf, just 3-4 minute walk. So our customers they enjoy a decent discount when they play and then have a salad afterwards. So
and I guess it does fit into this whole health and wellness sector anyway, doesn't it? The nice crossover from healthy eating and sport and being active.
Yeah, definitely.
As my regular listeners know, I like to close on three questions. So I'd like to take one at a time, if that's okay. Your greatest inspiration or mentor?
I don't actually have one mentor. I wish I had. I think it would have made life a little bit easier. So because of that, I am actually a mentor to younger people starting off their careers. But my inspiration has been through books and podcasts, I would say, and not a few numbers. I'm always on the hunt for good, inspiring stories from founders or successful people. So I would say that's a more of a broader answer. Like, I don't have one. I take great inspiration from my business partner, Martin Lorentzen. I mean, he's an incredibly successful entrepreneur. For those who don't know, he's a co-founder of Spotify. In conversations with him, I get incredibly inspired because it's the vision and the thinking of someone like him. It's so grand. It's just sometimes so hard to relate to. When I look at smaller things, and then he's more on a how do we change the world to something else. That's amazing. But yeah, overall, I would say reading books and podcasts is my way of feeding myself with inspiration.
Yes, I suppose it's different, isn't it? You work in the business, work on the business, and I guess work on the world is above that.
Yeah, exactly.
And then a book or a podcast which has inspired you?
A book that I would recommend is called The Lean Startup by Eric Ries. It's a great, great book. I recommend it to anyone who's interested in getting into the entrepreneurial world. I think someone recommended it to me, and I kind of used it as a Bible for starting my first real business, Urban Greens. And it's been with me. That mindset has been with me. I don't want to go too much into detail of what it does, but it basically, in summary, it's talking about how to pivot, how to constantly be pivoting and being able to launch with an MVP rather than working on your product till it's perfect, test the market, but being able to be nimble. And I think, you know, you asked me about how we went through COVID and all these sort of things. This was a great book to have read before we went into those challenges.
Well, that's a great Apple story. Never buy first generation Apple products.
Yeah, exactly.
What piece of advice would you give to a young person starting out on their career?
So again, from my own perspective here, I think at a young age, I knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I've had a few talks to students that are about to embark on their career with the mindset that they one day want to start their own business. My advice would be, as you enter into the corporate world, it's a great place to learn. See yourself as walking around with an empty toolbox. And throughout your journey, you just collect as many tools as you possibly can and put them inside of your toolbox and just be hungry for knowledge and experience. And these are tools that you later on in life can use for building your business, but also work on your mentality of being a problem solver, being sort of challenges will come. You may not face them the same way as an employee, but just be aware of the fact that the more problems you solve, the further in life as an entrepreneur you will come. So prepare both the mindset of being a problem solver, but also collecting these tools that down the line you will be able to use. And I would say third advice that goes hand in hand with these two are be patient. Don't rush into climbing that ladder or trying to get on a higher salary. It's, at the end of the day, the journey is a marathon. So don't sprint it through your career. I think I personally was a little bit too eager and I was jumping from one place to another, which wasn't really. If you do too much, I think it's not in your favor. But yeah, that would be my advice.
I think they're very wise words. I very much like your toolbox analogy. That's very clever. Aaron, this has been really informative. Thank you so much for your time. I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thank you so much, Nick. And let me know when you want to play some paddle and I'll hook you up.
I'll definitely be there. Thanks for listening to A Different Perspective, a Zeus podcast. If you'd like to feature on the podcast or get in touch, you can contact me on live@zeuscapital.co.uk. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.